This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and you're listening to Night Transmissions, where you're going to hear stuff for the next couple of hours or so. I don't know, really. That's kind of up to you. Most of what you're going to hear isn't true. Oh, I won't lie to you. Well, mostly I won't lie to you. Most of what I say will be true, but this other stuff, that other stuff is calculated to keep you in suspense. Yeah, that's right. We're going to start off tonight with an episode of Suspense. There's hardly a radio series that is more venerable than Suspense. Suspense was one of the longest running, one of the most successful radio series ever produced. Suspense broadcast over 900 episodes between 1942 and 1962. Like tonight's show, the majority were crime dramas. They did often venture into science fiction and horror as well. They really began very strong on July the 22nd of 1940 with an episode entitled The Lodger, which premiered on a program called Forecast, which was a show that premiered pilot episodes of new series. It would be an uncommonly long period before the show would begin in a regular time slot. The very first episode that summer was an adaptation of a Hitchcock film, which was directed for radio by Alfred Hitchcock. Tonight's episode, entitled Nothing Up My Sleeve, aired on January the 5th of 1943.
For Suspense tonight, CBS presents Alyssa Landy and George Koulouris in Nothing Up My Sleeve by John Dixon Carr.
It's New Year's Eve, remember? Times Square is celebrating. The fiery lights flash no longer, but the crowds are still the same. Thronging, jostling, singing, drowning out a voice at the street corner when it says,
Fatal gun battle at Jamaica, read all about it. Fatal gun battle at Jamaica, read all about it.
But would that cry perhaps reach as far as a large and sedate country house some 20 miles from New York? Out there, the earth is sealed up with snow. The white pillars of the house rise up high and ghostly against it, showing no outward lights. A lonely house, this mansion in fir woods.
Just the place for a murder, I've always said.
Wouldn't surprise me either. These Ralphs are a funny lot.
And alone in that house tonight, apparently alone, is a man practicing shots in a billiard room, a long and paneled room at the back of the house. Now, look at Mr. Derek Ross, as tall and lean and well-tailored as ever. Many people don't like him. He's a little too supercilious, a little too sure of himself, too suggestive of the lifted lips and the glazed eyes. There he stands in the billiard room, under the snow-covered skylight, leaning over the green cloth under brilliant lights when...
Just a moment, please. Good shot. Yes, come in.
Excuse me, Mr. Ralph.
Oh, not at all.
Hey, but aren't you Miss...
I'm Dorothy Dale, your aunt's social secretary. Surely you remember that.
Oh, of course, of course. Forgive me for forgetting your name. You surprised me, Dorothy.
Yes, I thought I surprised you a little.
No, I mean you surprised me by being in the house at all.
Why?
Why? Well, this is New Year's Eve. Shouldn't you be out getting drunk and blowing cardboard horns and doing the other fantastic things that people do?
I haven't much heart for that tonight.
Please, don't become emotional, Dorothy. I detest emotion. If you're shivering, go over by the radiator.
Mr. Ross, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
Did you ever feel sick at heart?
Huh?
Physically sick, I mean, so that your insides turned over and you couldn't get your breath and... Did you?
No. No, I can't say I did. May I move you aside for just a moment? Thank you. Not bad.
Can't you guess why I came here to see you tonight?
No.
Because I'm in terrible trouble, Mr. Ross. Desperate trouble. And I think you can help me.
I can help you? How?
For one thing, you're making quite a name for yourself as a lawyer.
Yes, that's what others have told me.
For another thing, do you know a man named Sharp Morgan?
Sharp Morgan. Sharp, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Sharp Morgan. No, I'm sure I've never heard that name before.
You ought to know him. He's a little dark-faced man with most of his upper lip cut away in a knife fight so that you can see all his teeth. That's why they call him Sharp.
Oh, he sounds like an unpleasant-looking person.
He is, or was, a ghastly-looking person. You don't know him? He's not a client of yours?
No.
I don't believe you.
Just a moment, Miss Dorothy Dale. I must put down this cue and say a few words myself.
Please do.
I don't want to be offensive to you, but it seems to me that for a paid employee of my aunt, practically a servant, you're taking a great deal on yourself.
If you're trying to hurt me that way, you're succeeding. But go ahead.
You come to me at 11 o'clock at night. You come rushing into this billiard room. Observe, I call it a billiard room, though this is actually a pool table. Just as everything in life gets its wrong name.
I entirely agree.
Yes, but you agree about what?
That everything gets its wrong name. Honest men are called thieves, and thieves are called honest men.
Would you mind explaining that remark to
me? I can explain it very easily. I'm engaged to be married to Jerry Winton.
Well?
Don't say you don't know who Jerry Winton is. He was in college with you.
I played on our extremely second-rate baseball team with him, yes.
You never liked him, did you?
Liked him? I'm afraid I never noticed him.
Jerry Winton works at City and Provincial Bank on 51st Street. He's a tenor there. Does that mean anything to you?
No. You see, it's not my bank.
I was at the City and Provincial Bank yesterday afternoon. Yesterday afternoon, Mr. Ralph. Just before closing time. It was a dark day and the lights were on. There weren't many people in that big marble hall. I went up to Jerry's window, if that's what you call it. Can you cash a check for $1 million?
Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Jerry. You glad to see me?
I am not pleased to see you here, Dolly. Oh? I'm never pleased to see you here.
And why not?
Because I can't make love. Do you imagine anybody making love in a bank?
Oh, we might sneak into the president's office.
As a matter of fact, I've dreamed of holding a party in there. But it'll never happen, unless I'm fired, which is very likely.
Jerry, sometimes I wish you weren't so easygoing.
I'm not easygoing with the bank's money, Dolly. Otherwise, I'd be shoving it out to you through the window in double handfuls like this.
Jerry, for heaven's sake, no.
They can state your business, madam. The convict in the next cage is watching us already.
I want to cash a check. Here it is. $20. That is, if my account can stand it.
Yes, I think we can manage that. How will you have it?
Oh, it doesn't matter anyway. Jerry.
What's wrong?
Look over there.
Where?
Over there by that marble table with the pens and ink on it. The little man with no upper lip to his mouth and all his teeth showing.
Ugly looking devil, I admit.
He's carrying something like a violin case.
Hold on. I've seen that fellow someplace before.
Of course you have. Don't you remember where?
It was
out at Mr. Ralph's house in the country when you came to visit me last Sunday. The man with the teeth and five other men were coming out on the porch as we were going in.
Wait a minute, Dolly. That's not all.
What is it?
There's some very funny-looking customers in this bank right now.
Where?
At Mr. Wallace's window. At Mr. Robinson's window. And up by the guard at the front door.
They didn't seem to make any sound. as though they all wore rubber-soled shoes. Jerry, something's going to happen.
I know it is. Unless I can get off this stool and...
Now, just a corner of your attention, folks. Just stay where you are, all of you. Nobody
I can hide. Darling, I'm scared. Well,
watch out. Just stand still.
Oh, I don't dare turn around. The man with the
key? Yes, he's got it. He got the machine gun.
They don't want any funny business about alarm bells, see? One of the boys has already gone behind to take up the collection. Now just stay where you are, that's all you got to do.
You can't get away with that.
Oh, look, boys, here's a guy at the front with a nice mahogany desk and a plate with his name on it who says we can't get away with it.
That's
sure.
Don't do it,
Sean.
That wasn't in our orders.
So
we can't get away with it. He's crazy.
Now, you hear somebody else talking?
Jerry!
Thought I heard somebody away.
Oh,
you kid.
Move to one side of the window, Dolly. Move to one side of the window.
Don't worry, kid. I ain't gonna hide you.
No?
Not a bit of it. Thanks for helping us. You'll get your cut later.
What do you mean, my cut?
What I said. You'll get your share when we divvy up.
I don't know anything about this robbery.
Don't worry, kid. We'll take care of you.
I tell you, I don't know anything about this robbery.
Jerry!
Now, six ball in the end pocket.
Ah,
got it.
Are you listening, Mr. Ralph?
This Sharp Morgan must have been quite a fool. I grant you that.
He was a fool. He must have been crazy. But they've held Jerry at police headquarters just the same.
Well, that's very unfortunate if he's innocent.
You know he's innocent.
I'm afraid I don't know anything about it.
Don't you even know what happened today? Haven't you read the newspaper?
No.
The police trapped that whole gang in a Long Island farmhouse. There was a gunfight.
Oh, is that so? Well, no casualties, I hope.
You hope?
I must tell you again, Dorothy, don't be emotional. I detest emotion.
The whole gang were killed, every last one of them, including Sharp Morgan. So there's nobody to talk, nobody to tell. But,
as you were saying?
They didn't find the money.
What money?
The stolen money. $88,000 taken from that bank, and yet the police can't find a cent of it. Shall I tell you why, Mr. Ralph? Because it was passed on to somebody else for safekeeping.
Oh, passed on to somebody else.
That's what I said.
Well, perhaps your friend Jerry Winton could tell us where it is.
That's what the police think. Oh, can you imagine what he's going through tonight?
Well, it's not a pleasant way to spend New Year's Eve, I admit. Excuse me. But, you know, after all, the late Sharp Morgan did accuse Winton. Now, if he isn't guilty, why should Morgan accuse him?
Meanness.
I don't think I understand.
Meanness? The sort of meanness that some people call a sense of humor. Morgan saw Jerry in this house.
Oh, be careful, young lady. That's an actionable statement.
I've already made it to the police, thanks.
Oh, and did they believe you?
No.
They're a very intelligent crowd down at Center Street. And after all, your story isn't very credible.
Why not?
But Sharp Morgan sees your friend Winston, sees him for perhaps 10 seconds coming out of this house, and then accuses him of complicity in a bank robbery. Now, is that very likely?
Yes, very likely. If somebody put him up to it.
Again, I don't understand you.
Somebody deliberately told Morgan to accuse Jerry and get him into as much trouble as possible. Tell me, Mr. Ralph, why do you dislike Jerry so much?
You know, now that you mention that fellow, I can recall who he is.
Thanks for condescending to him.
Yes, yes, indeed. Why, he was the man in our class voted most likely to succeed. Now, let's see, where did you say he is tonight?
He's just where you put him.
You're trying my patience to the very limit, young woman.
And out in a Long Island farmhouse, there are 5 bodies full of bullet holes. 5 men who'll never speak again. And somewhere else, maybe not very far from here, is the man who engineered the whole robbery. Planned it and staged it and got his accomplices killed.
My goodness, he must have supernatural powers.
No witnesses, nobody to testify. Oh, if I could only find the money.
$88,000, I think you said.
If I could only find the money and prove who'd done it and prove Jerry innocent and just for 1 second get past that devilish smug mask of yours that's driving me.
Anything wrong, Dorothy?
No. No, nothing at all.
You've been following me round and round this table. Have you been looking at something?
Only admiring your billiard room, that's all.
Oh, you haven't been looking at the suitcase, for instance?
Oh, a suitcase?
Oh, over on the bench, under the cue rack. The suitcase that contains legal papers.
I hadn't even noticed it. Mr. Roth?
Yes, Dorothy?
I'm afraid I've taken up a lot of your time and not done myself any good and made something of a spectacle of myself.
Frankly, young woman, you have.
Well, if you won't help me, you won't. That's that. If you don't mind, I'd like to go now.
I suppose, my dear, I didn't choose to let you go.
But why? Why shouldn't you? What harm can I do?
Now, who was it? Was it Meredith who remarked that the last thing to be civilized by man will be woman? I think it was, yes. And, you know, and a slanderous woman can do a great deal of harm.
But I haven't done you any harm so far.
We're all alone in this house. There's not even a servant here. Now, if I chose to get between you and the door like this...
Keep away from me.
Oh, I'm not coming near you, Dorothy. I'm merely standing between you and the door. Now, I suppose you realize that I could turn very nasty if I like.
What are you going to do?
Do? Well, I'm going to open the door for you like this. I'm going to say, God bless you, my child, as befits a New Year's greeting. I'm going to show you out and wish you good night.
You don't mind?
Mind? Certainly not.
You've got something to hide, haven't you, Mr. Rolfe?
No. Nothing, young woman, that I can't hide. Good night.
Operator.
What number are you calling, please?
Operator, I want to get police headquarters in New York City. No, that doesn't take too long. Wait. Get me the local police station. This is Nallingford 8891.
The local police station?
Yes, that's right.
The number you want is Nallingford 326. I will ring them.
Thank you. Why is he so confident? What has he got up his sleeve?
Nallingford Police Station.
Oh, let me speak to the chief of police, please.
You're speaking to him, ma'am. Nobody else to stay up here on New Year's Eve.
Well, my name is Dale, Miss Dorothy Dale. I'm speaking from Greenacres, Mr. Derek Roth's house, about 2 miles up the post road. Do you know it?
Yes, I know it, but can't you talk louder? I can hardly hear you.
I don't dare talk loud. I'm speaking from a phone just outside the billiard room door.
Well, what about it?
Listen, you want to recover the city and provincial bank money, don't you?
Sure do, miss. That money's hot, but...
it's here. It's in this house, in this billiard room, now.
Oh, who's got it?
Derek Roth himself.
Look, miss, is this on the level?
I swear it's true. I've seen the money.
Roth's prominent people, you know.
I can't help that. There's a big suitcase completely full of money in packages fastened with the paper label of the city and provincial bank. And that's not his own bank.
Take it easy now.
The lid of the suitcase wasn't quite closed. He thought he'd be alone here tonight, and that's why he was careless.
Does he know you saw the money?
Did I see the money? I'm not quite sure.
You're not sure?
No, I could almost have sworn he knew I saw the money, but he didn't seem to care.
Be
careful. The bedroom door's opening.
I thought I heard someone using the telephone out here.
Excuse me, Mr. Roth. I only...
What's this about the door open?
These doors are rather thick, Dorothy, but I was under the impression that I heard somebody say police.
Yes. Well, yes, you did.
You weren't phoning the police by any chance, were you?
Yes, I was.
Why?
Go on.
Why?
As a matter of fact, I was trying to get in touch with Jerry. That's it. He's at police headquarters in New York, and I was trying to get in touch with him to see if they'd let me talk to him on New Year's Eve. You know, I thought it would cheer him up.
Look, miss, this is the Mallingford chief of police. Are you still there?
What's that? Mallingford?
Well, it's a New York call relayed through the local station. You don't mind?
Not at all. Please go right ahead. Oh, by the way.
What?
I don't think you will find that money, young woman. Good night.
Listen, miss. Are you still on the end of the wire, aren't you?
Yes, but I couldn't talk to you. He was here.
Who was there?
Derek Roth. He said I'd never find the money.
Well, no. He just smiles and smiles. He's got some trick up his sleeve. I know it.
Oh, have to be a good one.
Please never mind that. Can you come over now?
Oh, all right, miss. I'll take a chance. Who else is in the house with you?
Nobody. I'm all alone with him.
What are you going to do if he tries to light out with the money?
I don't see what I can do. That's all the more reason for you to get here quickly. I swear you'll find the money in that billiard room. Only hurry.
Seem a very long time to a waiting girl crouching in a cold and dim-lit hallway outside a closed door, hearing only the clicking of billiard balls and watching, wondering, and praying until...
Miss Dale. Miss Dale.
This way.
Shh. Miss Dale, I'm Joe Hollister, chief of police.
Yes, I recognized your voice.
The front door wasn't locked, so I just walked in.
I hoped you would. I didn't want to leave here.
Has Mr. Rolfe come out of that room since you talked to me?
No.
And according to what you claim, he's still in there with a suitcase full of money.
That's right, Mr. Hollister.
Now, look, miss, before we go any further, there's something I ought to tell you.
Well?
Well, I checked with New York about you.
And what did they say?
Yes, Mr. Hollister. And what did they say about her?
Mr. Ross.
I'm rather interested in knowing that myself.
So you could hear everything through that door?
Of course I could hear everything through the door, including your conversation with our friend, the chief of police. Good evening, Mr. Hollister.
Good evening, Mr. Ross. This young lady says...
I know, I know what she says. Will you come into the billiard room, please? Both of you?
Oh.
Thank you.
Just what trick are you up to now?
Trick? You talk of tricks.
Now, just a minute now. Take it easy. What I want to know is, where's this suitcase Miss Dale was talking about?
There it is.
What, you mean that empty suitcase on the bench beside you?
Empty suitcase?
Yes, that's what I said.
It wasn't empty when I left this room.
Chief, do you mind seeing for yourself?
Well, it isn't empty. It's empty now, miss.
Hollister, it will gratify me to clear this matter up here and now.
It'll gratify me, too.
I'm tired of this slanderous nonsense, and I mean to end it. This young woman told you that I had... What was it? Some $88,000 in this room only a few minutes ago.
I still say you had.
Curb your temper, please, while I ask you some straight questions. Can you do that?
You better answer them, miss.
All right, I'll try.
Did I or did I not leave the billiard room at any time?
No, you didn't.
Good. Well, there's only one door and no window. Only a skylight covered with snow. So I didn't leave that way, did I?
No, I suppose you didn't.
Therefore, unless you're lying... The money must still be in this room.
Yes.
Then where is it?
I don't know. You must have hidden it someplace.
Oh. Where?
I'm afraid Mr. Rouse is right, miss.
Take a look around you. One pool table. Comes apart so you can examine it. One radio. Go on, examine that too. One overhead light, one standing lamp, one bare bench, one rack of cues, one rack of pool balls. Now, that's everything. Now, can you tell me where I could hide enough money to fill a suitcase?
No, I can't.
It's impossible, miss. The stuff's not here.
It must be here. It's either here or else...
Or else what?
Or else it vanished.
Oh, Mr. Hollister, haven't we had quite enough of this?
Yes, I guess we have. Now, look here, Miss Dale. I like the way you talked, and I thought you were talking straight. Will you just tell me why you tried to string me along like that?
You know, I think I can tell you, Chief Hollister.
I wasn't exactly asking you, Mr. Ralph, but... Well, go ahead.
You know, perhaps, that she's engaged to a man who's mixed up in the city and provincial robbery.
He was not.
It was neither a very clever nor a very far-sighted attempt. I'm inclined to think that she'll not have a job when my aunt returns. But as I say, it was a case of any old attempt to shield Jerry Wilton.
Somebody mentioned my name.
Jerry! Oh, Jerry!
Jerry, I'm alive. I'm not a ghost. You needn't dive at me like
but
that.
How did you get here? How did you get away?
I was trying to tell you, miss, when our host butted in. The DA is convinced your young man had nothing to do with this.
That's right, Dolly. And I thought I'd better come out and take you back to New York with me.
I've never so glad to see anybody in my life. Put your arms around me.
Darling. I don't suppose you'd mind if I picked up this cue and went on practicing. Try the eight ball all the way down the table.
Come on, Dolly. It'll be New Year's in a few minutes. There's nothing to worry about.
There is something to worry about. He's got the money, the whole $88,000. I know it. I'm sure of it. Only we can't find it. It's hidden somewhere in this room.
As I said before, haven't we had just about enough of this?
The chief of police there won't believe me, but it's true.
I've heard a lot about that money myself.
I'll bet you have, son.
For nothing but hot money, hot money, hot money, and where is it, where is it, where is it, until I thought I was going off my nut. If I could prove Derek Rolfe had anything to do with this, I'd... Sally, what's the matter?
Mr. Hollister.
Yes, miss?
I think I know now where he's hidden the money.
Well, that was a bad shot, Mr. Rolfe. You've made the white ball jump clear off the table.
Well, there are plenty of others on the table.
I tell you, I know where he's hidden it.
Is it in this room?
Yes.
But where? In the pool table? In the radio? In some secret panel?
No.
You better speak up, Dolly.
Has it ever struck you, any of you, that there is such a thing as an invisible piece of furniture?
An invisible piece of furniture? You mean we can't see it?
No, it's in plain sight, smack in front of your eyes. But nobody ever sees it. You can't see it now.
We may not understand you, Dolly, but by George, Derek Rolfe does. Look at his face.
Yes. I'm looking at it.
What's the matter with all of you?
Please don't become emotional, Mr. Rolfe. I detest emotion.
Miss, there's a reward of $10,000 for the recovery of that money. If you know where it is, tell us.
There's nothing easier. It's...
Before that young woman says something she may regret, please listen to me.
You've got him, Dolly. I don't know how or why, but you've got him.
Go on, Mr. Rolfe.
Tell me, Winton. You and I used to play on the same baseball team, didn't we?
That's right. What about it?
What did I play on that team?
You were the pitcher. Why?
Was I good?
You had the best control and the best fast one I ever... Wait a minute. Why are you picking up that pool ball?
What are you going to do? Take it easy, Mr. Rolfe.
You three are across the room from me. I have a number of rather dangerous objects on the table here. And I'll split that girl's skull if she says another word.
Don't be a blasted fool.
Think I can't do it? Oh. Well, does that convince you I haven't lost my pitching arm? You didn't even get a chance to raise that gun.
Oh.
No, you don't. Don't try to pick it up. I said it'd lie down the floor.
Get behind me, Dolly.
You say where you are. We'll step up first base and...
Maybe you'd better listen to him, Miss Dale. Well, what are you going to do, Ralph? You can't keep us here forever.
I don't propose to keep you there forever. I'm not so enamored of your company.
Then what's the game?
Well, I'll make a bargain with you.
Well?
My car's outside with a little more gas than the state allows. Give me one clear hour to get away. Well, what do you say?
I'm a cop, Mr. Ralph. I can't make any bargains with you.
No?
No, and I'm coming over there after you.
And you'll compel me to start throwing...
Down, Dolly, down under the table.
You missed that one, Mr. Ralph.
I'm not missing this one.
That's a shame to butt that Turek, Mr. Ralph, but I'm still coming for you.
You've lost your control, old son. You're done for.
That's right. That was the wildest pitch yet.
Dolly, look. Don't get up. Look.
What is it?
The radiator. The same radiator. He's knocked the whole thing sideways. Did you ever see that happen to a radiator before?
Of course not, because it's a dummy radiator.
Dummy radiator?
Yeah, I cut you off. I'm not too old to handle a prey like you.
You haven't even got a search on it.
Now take a chance. There. What was that about? A dummy radiator?
Yes. Look here. It's got a little oil burner inside to make it give out heat.
Yeah?
And the hinges at the back to form a lot of compartments where you can hide as much money as you like.
I saw the hinges when he told me to go over to the radiator, but I didn't guess what they meant. It's really a safe that never attracts attention because nobody ever notices it.
And the stuff's here, all right.
There, Mr. Hollister. That's what I saw in the suitcase.
I told you there was a $10,000 reward for that, miss.
Oh, did you hear that? Turn on the radio, Jerry. Go on, turn it on. Welcome in the new year. Didn't you tell me, all of you, that the money was hot?
Tonight's story of suspense. Columbia presents these tales of mystery, intrigue, and dangerous adventure for your relaxation and enjoyment.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back. From time to time, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, networks and individuals would attempt to resurrect radio drama. The Mutual Network did it, CBS did it, ABC did it. Next we have an episode from the 1960s, and ABC's Theater 5 presentation of Children of Death from February the 7th of 1965. Then immediately after that, we're going to make a trip back to the LibriVox for a story involving Napoleon and a ghost. That's right, it's Napoleon and the Spectre by Charlotte Bronte.
Mr. Thorne, this is the best of my collection.
This is amazing, McCrane. I see that you haven't specialized, have you? Lion, leopard, water buffalo.
Panther, cheetah, cougar. Well, she's touched all the bases.
That's the largest polar bear head I've ever seen.
Lester thinks my trophies make the house look like a museum.
One thought comes to mind. What's left?
I don't intend to try for the abominable snowman, if that's what you mean. But something will catch my interest.
Oh, confess, Liz, it has. The fish.
Did you say fish?
Japanese fighting fish. The tanks are over here against the wall. I'll turn on some more lights.
Oh. Well, they're beautiful.
Hate and fury compressed into tiny bodies. Liz tends them as if they were children.
Well, they are. Children of death. A lion is a fraud compared to them. If he isn't hungry, you can walk right up to him. The other big cats will attack or not, according to the whim of the moment. But these beauties have a single purpose. They'll fight any time and there's no truce. Put two in a single tank and only one stays alive. They're the most perfect killers in the world.
Theater 5 presents Miss Wendy Berry in Children of Death.
The phone, you're really getting the $50 tour.
I appreciate it. These fish are certainly a novel hobby, Mrs. Crane.
Wouldn't macabre be a better word?
Lester, where are Tom and Alan?
On the terrace. Alan seemed very concerned about the proposed mental hospital.
My attorney has a conditioned reflex against charitable donations.
Well, sweet. $1 million ain't hay, as the jet set would say.
Speaking of money, I talked to Carter about your last bill for his bookstore. He won't charge anything from now on without my approval.
Liz, you didn't. My new book.
If you must research your latest plaything, get a card to the public library. You'll be amazed at all the books they have. All free.
No, you don't want to understand my work.
Mrs. Crane,
Don't be embarrassed. He'll sulk a little, and then come back as if nothing had happened. Nothing ever does with Lester. Besides, this gives us a moment to be alone.
Yes. After our phone conversation, I kept wondering if this wasn't a job for a doctor instead of a retired criminologist.
I already have a doctor. These incidents I told you about, petty things individually, but rather damaging collectively. The feeling is growing in our community that Elizabeth Porter Crane may be a little unbalanced. Here's a written list of the Watson Wends.
Flour is ordered. Servants dismissed.
Even a car, which I presumably told Lester to buy.
You have no recollection of any of this?
None whatsoever.
You could be suffering from recurring amnesia.
I'm not paying you for guesses. Your meeting with Lester was fortunate. It makes contacts easy for us. Do whatever you think necessary and let me know when you get an answer.
But...
No buts. Besides, we're about to be interrupted.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm lucky from that excellent dinner, but we really should go over the plans for the hospital.
Well, of course, Tom. Come into the library with me.
Elizabeth, before you finalize anything, I'd like to make some suggestions regarding the liquid position of the estate.
I'll be in your office at 9 tomorrow morning, Alan. Satisfactory?
It'll have to be. You're the boss. Thanks for the dinner and good night, all.
Good night.
Oh, leaving, Alan?
Yes. Good night, Lester.
It is getting late.
Oh, no. Let's have a nightcap.
Oh, do stay. Lester can do the honors. Tom and I won't be long.
Well, quite a woman.
An American legend. Elizabeth Porter Crane, business tycoon and big game hunter.
Colorful.
Like the stories about Martin Thorne, manhunter.
Oh, well, that was just newspaper exuberance at the time I retired.
I'm an avid reader. Frankly, our chance meeting at the golf club wasn't quite by chance.
Oh?
Someone pointed you out to me and mentioned that you were down here for a long weekend.
Oh.
And now, I'm going to try and take advantage of a short acquaintanceship.
The direct approach, eh?
Yes. In your career, you had experience with the introverted, the manic, the various types that can, under certain conditions, become a menace to society or to themselves.
What are you getting at?
My wife. I've been terribly worried about Elizabeth lately.
In what way?
Isn't it obvious? African safaris, expeditions down the Amazon, those fighting fish. She watches them, you know, watches them kill each other. I don't know, perhaps I'm oversensitive.
No, it's not a common spectator sport.
Liz has a morbid preoccupation with death, which leads me to these family heirlooms on the mantelpiece.
As I notice them, matched derringers in excellent condition, pre-Civil War, aren't they?
Yes, yes. They're commonly known as gambler's guns because they were used by Mississippi River card sharps.
A collector's item.
One of them is a death gun.
What?
These pistols belong to Caswell Porter, Elizabeth's grandfather. He used one to blow a hole in his head.
Oh.
Well, perhaps now you understand my concern.
There. Dispose of these securities immediately. That will provide the necessary cash.
Oh, I wish you would reconsider this donation to the hospital fund.
My mind's made up, Alan. It's not a mistake.
Sometime, couldn't you make one? It's hard to work for a boss who is always right.
When I do make a mistake, it's king-sized. Now, I've got a hypothetical question for your legal mind.
The, quote, good friend, end quote?
Oh, never mind the comments. And never mind the hypothetical, come to think of it. What would happen to my estate if I were committed to an institution?
Institution?
A mental institution. Lester is my heir. Would he take over the estate if I was declared insane?
No.
No what?
No Porter Enterprises for Lester. In the event you were ever declared mentally unbalanced, a board of trustees would be set up to administer the estate until such time as you recover or die. But why the question?
My husband may be showing signs of initiative. I'm wondering if he's hatching a plot.
Well, if it's relative to your sanity, what's the motive?
This could be another choice bit of gossip. I suggest you forget if you want the annual retainer I pay you.
Shouldn't we discuss this? If there is some scheme...
Alan, please. Anything Lester dreams up, I can handle.
No.
Sit down.
The distinguished counselor looks jumpy.
Distinguished counselor? Don't you mean Elizabeth's leg, man? Sorry, I guess her candor is contagious. Tom, I'm risking my annual retainer from Porter Enterprises, but I have to talk to you.
Right.
You're Elizabeth's oldest friend, if she has a friend.
She has one.
Elizabeth just left my office. She wanted to find out what would happen if she were declared insane.
Insane?
Isn't it our duty to put the estate in trust till Elizabeth recovers?
From what?
Mental instability.
Oh.
Obviously, she's worried about it. It was her grandfather's suicide, remember? And her actions have certainly been strange lately. Now, you're her doctor, and I'm her lawyer. I think that perhaps together we could swing it.
Alan, let's get something straight. The Porters have always been brilliant, and the line between genius and insanity is sometimes a thin one. But as far as I'm concerned, Elizabeth is as sane as you are.
So, I was right.
Not about Elizabeth.
About you. The Porter Memorial Hospital means a lot to you, doesn't it?
And to the community.
Your fund drive can't get off the ground without Elizabeth's $1 million donation.
What's your point?
As long as Elizabeth is in charge of the estate, you get your hospital. You're willing to overlook anything.
Before you start a rumor that could be damaging to my practice, answer me a question about your business, counselor.
Yours on rebuttal, Doctor.
Elizabeth has handled her business like all the Porters, meaning she's been making money hand over fist. Now, why does this charitable gesture bother you? Is it because there might be an audit of the books? You haven't been tampering with funds, have you, Counselor?
No. What a damaging little whisper that could be.
Rumor is a double-edged weapon.
So, it's a Mexican standoff.
Let's call it an armed truce.
At least we both know where we stand. Before I leave, have you given Elizabeth a checkup recently?
Last week, why?
It occurred to me that there's another pawn on the board.
Lester?
Elizabeth feels he's up to something. She has a nasty habit of being right.
Lester isn't poisoning her, if that's what you have in mind.
I don't know what I have in mind. Now, you know, Elizabeth's marriage...
Which was not made in heaven.
No, no. Lester isn't the driving, empire-building Porter type at all.
Agreed.
Now, you don't suppose Elizabeth is thinking of disposing of her one big mistake. Lester.
Well, you certainly run the gamut. First, Elizabeth's crazy. Second, Lester's trying to get rid of her. Now she's planning to do away with him. By the way, am I trying to kill anyone?
No motive. Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Counselor.
Thorne. Lester's out and the servants are in the kitchen preparing for tonight's party. By the way, you're invited.
I plan to return to New York.
Your work is finished?
I think so.
Come into the study. Have you got an answer?
I've come to a conclusion. You gave me a list of incidents, situations where you apparently suffered a loss of memory. I checked out every one.
And?
They all had one thing in common. A middleman.
Lester?
Yes. Let's take one instance, since it applies to them all. On the 4th of this month, you supposedly told your husband to order 2 dozen roses from the florist and then completely forgot about it. But no one heard you tell him. There were no witnesses. And my guess is that you never told him to buy the flowers. He just said you did. However...
Well, what's wrong with that line of reasoning?
I had a chat with your husband the night I was here for dinner. It's a point, but he never mentioned that your memory was playing tricks. Instead, he seemed concerned about your preoccupation with death.
Anything else?
He made reference to your grandfather.
You mean his suicide? I'm making out your check, Mr. Thorne. You've given me my answer.
How?
Well, I'll give you a clue. When you're hunting the big cats, as I have, the first problem is to find them. And if you want to be sure they're in front of you and in the open, not behind you in the bush, it's a question of establishing who's hunting who.
I don't follow that.
Well, I mean that now I know where the lion is. And I hope you'll change your mind about this evening. It'll be a small affair, and I'm going to announce my donation of $1 million to the Caswell Porter Memorial Hospital.
And you'll solicit other donations?
Yes, but that's not the part that would interest you. Some other things might. There's the dominant wife, the ineffectual husband, the family doctor with ambitions to head up a new mental clinic, and a lawyer with a frustrated power complex. Do come in, Mr. Thorne. Death may dance at our party tonight. No, I didn't forget my little beauties. Dinner's on time as usual.
Oh, Liz. I couldn't find you, so I figured you'd come up here to feed those little monsters.
That's not all you figured, is it, Lester?
What?
Isn't this the zero hour for you?
What's that mean?
Lester, pretense is tiresome and you're so obvious. Inching your way to the mantle. It was a clever scheme.
What scheme?
The rumors, dear. Whispers about my faulty memory. My morbid moods and preoccupation with death. But you weren't trying to prove I was mentally unstable. You were laying the foundation for my death.
You told somebody.
What? And spoil the hunt? Of course not.
Well, then it will work. Elizabeth hasn't been quite right lately. Seems definitely unbalanced. She just went into the study and, like her grandfather...
shot herself with the same gun. A good speech. But to make it effective, I have to be dead. Well, go ahead, Lester. From where you're standing, you can almost reach the mantelpiece. The gun is loaded there, waiting, but... the other gun is right here in the drawer of the desk. And it's loaded, too.
What?
Oh, don't lose your nerve now, Lester, because I know. And I can't let you off the hook to try again. We're like my children of death, aren't we? This room is our tank, and only one of us can remain alive.
You don't know. Oh!
Let's put your gun back in the mantelpiece and place the weapon in your hand. There. The stage is set. And it's set for your suicide, Lester. Not mine.
Elizabeth, I know this is a terrible shock, but you're bearing up beautifully.
Oh, I have no choice. If I thought hysterics would bring Lester back, I'd dissolve into a flood of tears.
You're an amazing woman.
Oh, a fortunate woman, Alan, in having you and Tom and Mr. Thorne to help me. Mr. Thorne, you're familiar with what has to be done.
Mm.
And perhaps you could call the police, and with your influence, maybe we can keep this from the other guests.
I'm sure the three of us can take care of everything.
Of course. Why don't you go upstairs and lie down, Elizabeth? I'll get you a sedative. I wouldn't advise that right now.
Pardon?
I have had a lot of experience in matters of this kind. And there's a procedure that the police automatically follow.
What's that?
You're a lawyer. You should know that they will take a paraffin test of Mr. Crane's hands to prove that he fired a gun tonight. And if the test is negative, they'll run the same check on Mrs. Crane. I think her test would prove positive.
What are you suggesting?
Oh, shut up, Tom. You mean the police will know that I fired the Derringer?
Definitely. Death did dance at your party tonight. And it was murder.
All right. Call the police, Thorne. I killed him.
My dear, you are hysterical.
Don't admit anything.
Quiet, both of you. There's a lot to be done. Alan, I want all the money allocated for the Caswell Porter Memorial Mental Hospital to be transferred to the fund immediately. Tom, I want your promise that you will push through the fund drive and start construction on the hospital as quickly as possible.
But Elizabeth...
Oh, think, will you? Think. Obviously, I'm going on trial for murder. It's equally obvious that we'll have only one possible defense. If that defense is successful, who knows? I may be the first patient in the Porter Memorial Mental Hospital. I'll certainly want a comfortable suite.
Presented Children of Death, starring Miss Wendy Berry. Written by Frank Thomas, directed by Ted Bell. Featured in the cast, George Petrie, David Kerman, Paul McGrath, and Jack Manning. Script editor, Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Ralph Herman. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Otter. Executive producer for Theater 5, Mr. Lee Bowman.
Napoleon and the Spectre by Charlotte Bronte. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Napoleon and the Spectre by Charlotte Bronte. Well, as I was saying, the Emperor got into bed. Chevalier, says he to his valet. Let down those window curtains and shut the casement before you leave the room. Chevalier did as he was told, and then, taking up his candlestick, departed. In a few minutes the Emperor felt his pillow becoming rather hard, and he got up to shake it. As he did so, a slight rustling noise was heard near the bedhead. His Majesty listened, but all was silent as he lay down again. Scarcely had he settled into a peaceful attitude of repose when he was disturbed by a sensation of thirst. Lifting himself on his elbow, he took a glass of lemonade from the small stand which was placed beside him. He refreshed himself by a deep draught. As he returned the goblet to its station, a deep groan burst from a kind of closet in one corner of the apartment. "Who's there?" cried the Emperor, seizing his pistols. "Speak, or I'll blow your brains out!" This threat produced no other effect than a short, sharp laugh, and a dead silence followed. The Emperor started from his couch, and hastily throwing on a robe of chamber, which hung over the back of a chair, stepped courageously to the haunted closet. As he opened the door, something rustled. He sprang forward, sword in hand. No soul or even substance appeared, and the rustling, it was evident, proceeded from the falling off a cloak, which had been suspended by a peg from the door. Half ashamed of himself, he returned to bed. Just as he was about once more to close his eyes, the light of the three wax tapers, which burned in a silver branch over the mantelpiece, was suddenly darkened. He looked up. A black, opaque shadow obscured it. Sweating with terror, the Emperor put out his hand to seize the bell rope, but some invisible being snatched it rudely from his grasp, and at the same instant the ominous shade vanished. "Pooh!" exclaimed Napoleon. "It was but an ocular delusion." "Was it?" whispered a hollow voice, in deep mysterious tones close to his ear. "Was it a delusion, Emperor of France? No. All those hast heard and seen is sad forewarning reality. Rise, lifter of the eagle standard. Awake, swear of the lily scepter. Follow me, Napoleon, and thou shalt see more." As the voice ceased, a form dawned on his astonished sight. It was that of a tall, thin man, dressed in a blue surtout, edged with gold lace. It wore a black cravat very tightly round its neck, and confined by two little sticks placed behind each ear. The countenance was livid, the tongue protruded from between the teeth, and the eyes all glazed and bloodshot, started with a frightful prominence, borne their sockets. "Mon Dieu!" exclaimed the Emperor. "What do I see? Spectre? Whence cometh thou? The apparition spoke not, but gliding forward beckoned Napoleon with uplifted finger to follow. Controlled by a mysterious influence which deprived him of the capability of either thinking or acting for himself, he obeyed in silence. The solid wall of the apartment fell open as they approached, and when both had passed through, it closed behind them with a noise like thunder. They would now have been in total darkness had it not been for a dim light which shone round the ghost and revealed the damp walls of a long vaulted passage. Down this they proceeded with mute rapidity. Ere long, a cool, refreshing breeze which rustled wailing up the vault and caused the emperor to wrap his loose nightdress close around announced their approach to the open air. This they soon reached, and Nap found himself in one of the principal streets of Paris. "Worthy spirit," said he, shivering in the chill night air, "permit me to return and put on some additional clothing. I will be with you again presently."
"Forward," replied his companion sternly.
He felt compelled, in spite of the rising indignation which almost choked him, to obey. On they went through the deserted streets, till they arrived at a lofty house built on the banks of the Seine. Here the spectre stopped. The gates rolled back to receive them, and they entered a large marble hall, which was partly concealed by a curtain drawn across, though the half-transparent folds of which a bright light might be seen burning with dazzling lustre. A row of fine female figures, richly attired, stood before the screen. They wore on their heads garlands of the most beautiful flowers, but their faces were concealed by ghastly masks representing death's heads. "What is all this mummery?" cried the emperor, making an effort to shake off the mental shackles by which he was so unwillingly restrained. "Where am I, and why have I been brought here?"
"Silence," said the guide, lolling out still further his black and bloody tongue. "Silence if thou would escape instant death."
The emperor would have replied, his natural courage overcoming the temporary awe to which he had first been subjected. But just then a strain of wild supernatural music swelled behind the huge curtain, which waved to and fro, and bellied slowly out as if agitated by some internal commotion or battle of waving winds. At the same moment an overpowering mixture of the scents of mortal corruption, blent with the richest eastern odours, stole through the haunted hall. A murmur of many voices was now heard at a distance, and something grasped his arm eagerly from behind. He turned hastily round. His eyes met the well-known countenance of Marie-Louise.
"What, are you in this infernal place too?" said he. "What has brought you here?"
"Will your majesty permit me to ask the same question of yourself?" said the empress, smiling. He made no reply. Astonishment prevented him. No curtain now intervened between him and the light. It had been removed as if by magic, and a splendid chandelier appeared suspended over his head. Throngs of ladies, richly dressed, but without death's head masks, stood round, and a due portion of gay cavaliers was mingled with them. Music was still sounding, but it was seen to proceed from a band of mortal musicians stationed in an orchestra near at hand. The air was yet redolent of incense, but it was incense unblended with stench.
"Mon Dieu!" cried the emperor. "How has all this come about? Where in the world is Piche?"
"Piche?" cried the empress. "What does your majesty mean? Had you not better leave the apartment and retire to rest?"
"Leave the apartment? Why? Where am I?"
"In my private drawing room, surrounded by a few particular persons of the court, whom I had invited this evening to a ball. You entered a few minutes since in your nightdress with your eyes fixed and wide open. I suppose from the astonishment you now testify that you were walking in your sleep." The emperor immediately fell in a fit of catalepsy, in which he continued during the whole of the night and the greater part of the next day. End of Napoleon and the Spectre by Charlotte Bronte.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Wrong Word. A rich industrialist named Wade paid a genealogist a huge sum of money to trace his family history and invited me to inspect the results. According to the genealogist, Wade was the descendant of an English earl. The genealogist showed a letter which included the quote, "Due to kaleidoscopic events taking place in the colonies, I intend to leave England and join the forces of Washington and Liberty. The letter was dated 1777. I told Wade his family historian was a quack. In a moment, I'll tell you why. In the case of the wrong word, the expression kaleidoscopic events was used. The letter was dated 1777. It so happens the kaleidoscope was not invented until 1817, so the letter and the genealogist were fake. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Up next is an episode of Escape from March the 29th of 1953 called The Invader. The Invader is a simple science fiction story, but holds up pretty well as one of Escape's best episodes. It has some pretty strong similarities with the Twilight Zone's 1961 episode, The Invaders. You may remember that one. That was the one with Agnes Moorehead. Or to an X-1 episode from 1956 called Pictures Don't Lie. But the Twilight Zone story was much grimmer. Neither of them are nearly as amusing as the Escape story. It won't surprise you if I tell you this, that it's an invasion from space. I won't tell you anything much more about it. There's one voice. There's one voice that's going to be extremely familiar. And I'll tell you a little bit more about who that was after the break. In the meantime...
The everyday grind. Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you... Escape. Escape. Designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Escape brings you Michael Gray's exciting story, The Invader. Observation post is a slit trench less than 2 miles from ground zero of Operation Doorstep 8A bomb test. The time exactly 30 seconds to H-hour. That's the voice of our official guide, Colonel Jim Donovan.
All personnel, open on protective glasses and get below central vestments. We have H-hour minus 16, 15, 14... 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
There it goes. There it is. You'll hear the sound of the explosion any second now.
that flash, Commander?
Yes. Check the cyclo gauges for reaction.
Yes, sir. No reaction, zero count. What an extraordinary race.
Very primitive. The main object appears to be to kill each other off at periodic intervals.
I wonder why the Council doesn't order extinction.
There's hope. That's why we've been sent.
But the red zero disks vanished on the same job last Velo. Why waste more lives? The things should be exterminated.
Don't be unscientific. The red zero disks probably disobeyed orders and landed on water.
Water?
Yes, water.
Oh, what a place. What do they call those creatures, Commander?
Humans.
Humans? What an odd name.
I'm afraid they're a very odd race.
Yes, what?
I saw the bomb test on television this morning. You see it in school?
No, dear.
Oh. Where are you going now?
Into the lab. Call me when dinner's ready, will you, dear?
Albert, I want to talk to you.
Oh, yes, dear, of course.
I saw Mrs. Warren today.
Yes, dear.
Will you stop messing around and pay attention to what I'm saying?
Yes, dear.
I should merely like to remind you that Mrs. Warren is your school principal's wife. She hinted that he's not pleased with your work. In fact, he's not pleased at all. Albert, did you hear what I said?
Yes, dear.
Come back here. Now, stand still and listen to me. How do you think I feel having the principal's wife laughing at you and laughing at me, too? This is the third job you've had in the past 2 years, and you are going to keep this one. I know it's hard for a scientific genius to settle down teaching 12th grade chemistry, but this time you're going to stick, I mean it, Albert. You're making yourself the laughing stock of the school with your crazy experiments, and it's got to stop. I'm just not going to spend the rest of my life following you around from job to job like a gypsy.
Well, of course, dear. Well, I understand.
You'd better understand. I'm not going to stand for it anymore. And if you're not down for dinner in 5 minutes, there won't be any dinner for you.
Commander? Magnetrons oscillating.
Probably a magnetic storm.
No, it's a definite signal on our channel. That's the Council's calling.
Arise and bring it in.
Station MXA calling. Station MXA calling. Station MXA over and out.
That's not the Council. Check the frequency.
The emergency band.
Somebody's playing a joke. Tell them to clear the ether.
Stellar disk white zero now. Who's called?
Moment. Ask for code check.
Stellar disk white zero now. Give name. Code check.
Station MXA? Where are you?
Give me the frequent tone. Listen, MXA. This is Commander of Delta Ship White Zero Null on space mission. Get off this channel. Make a note for the log. We'll report it back to the Council. What was his identification?
Sounded like MXA.
MXA. MXA. check the cyclo listing.
There's no such station listed, Riff.
There must be. Cross-check and fix.
Yes, Riff. No. Absolutely no listing.
Hmm. Oh, no. It's impossible. Those blundering primates couldn't have the intelligence
to... What primates, Riff?
Humans. It's incredible, but... Use the Magna Band. We'll keep emergency open. Fix and raise MXA immediately.
Delta ship white 0-0. Delta ship white 0-0.
Are you coming down to supper?
Martha. Martha, it's amazing. I've made contact. I spoke to them.
What do?
Delta white 0-0. I've checked the station list. There's no such call time. It means only one thing, Martha. One thing. Space. Men in space. You know what that means?
Oh, stop it! Albert, when are you going to grow up? Your dinner's getting cold.
Commander Delta White 0-0, calling station MXA. Where are you located?
Commander Delta White 0-0, this is station MXA. I'm located at La Mirada, California.
What planet?
Planet Earth. The continent of North America. Who are you? Repeat who you are. Over.
Are you human?
Yes. You aren't...
No, of course not. We're of Epsilon from the race of planetoid Delta.
Delta?
On mission of exploration for the Council.
Council?
The Council of Quantum Major, the Nebulae Ursula. We're arriving in your atmosphere in 2 delos more to examine your planet. We cannot continue this unauthorized contact without permission from the Council. If granted, we will raise contact again at your earliest light time tomorrow.
Oh, did you hear that, Martha? Did you hear?
Are you or are you not coming down to dinner?
Oh, I've done it. Out there in space is another intelligence, another race. And I've made contact.
For the last time, are you coming down?
Martha Liz and I have made one of the most important discoveries of the century. The first contact with another world, another people, or something. Think what it'll mean for civilization. Think what they'll bring. Maybe a whole new way of life.
Just another one of those radio amateur friends of yours playing the joke.
Oh, no, Martha, that's impossible. The frequency's completely outside the UHF band. No station could even reach the range. Much less... transmit speech. Oh, yes, tomorrow I can ask questions.
I stood enough. I've watched you wreck job after job with your silly crackpot ideas. I've been hoping that you'd come to your senses.
Oh, but you heard, Mom.
I've put up with this pile of junk long enough. If you don't come to your senses once and for all, I'm through with you.
Oh, but Mom.
I'll give you 5 minutes more to wash and get downstairs or I'm through Albertana. I mean it.
No.
Wake up, Albert.
Oh, I'm kind of seven. Oh, yes, of course.
Hurry up and get showered. You'll be late.
I'm going. Oh, I mustn't be late. Now, early light time. Early light time. Oh, I hope I'm not late.
Where are you going?
He said he'd make contact earlier and late. Light time. Don't worry about breakfast, dear. Just fix some coffee.
Showered and dressed now. Now, do you hear me? You know what the principal said the last time you were late?
Martha, I'm not going to school. Don't you understand, dear? Today I'm going to contact Delta White. No. In fact, I'm going to contact him right now.
You mean to tell me that you're risking your job for that crazy...
Oh, Martha, it's not crazy. Nobody on this earth could have transmitted on that frequency. There's only one explanation.
All right.
I can see that there's only one solution to this. And you've asked for it.
Martha, go. Come on. Martha, stop. What are you going to do? Martha!
Get away from that door.
Martha,
by the
please.
Time I finish with this place, get out of my way. All you'll need is a broom.
Martha, stop. Stand on my chair, Martha. Now, then, you listen to me for a change. For 14 years, I've been teaching sniveling little monsters to blow themselves up for less money than our garbage collector. And for 10 years, I've listened to you nagging me out of any sort of manhood. But if you lay one finger on it at once, I'll come in this room again. Without my express permission, I'll kill you.
MXA calling Delta White Zero Null. Station MXA calling Delta White Zero Null.
This is Delta White Zero Null to station MXA. Can you read us?
You're coming in loud and clear.
Council authorizes to continue contact. What is your name and function?
My name's Tanner. Albert Tanner. I'm a chemistry teacher in La Mirada High School.
A scientist?
Yes. Well, kind of, in a way.
We, too, have service of learning. Did you construct this magnetron channel?
Yes, but I'm afraid it's a bit elementary. I had to use war surplus stuff, and that's never very satisfactory.
Oh. Is there war in your territory at this moment?
Oh, no. No, Commander. Oh, everything's quite peaceful here.
Good. We're looking for a suitable land space and don't want to arrive in the middle of your hostilities.
Well, you'd be very welcome, Commander. With plenty of space and open fields all around us, yeah, it'd be a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Tanner.
You're welcome, Commander. Might I ask, what is the position of your planet?
Planetoid Delta is 5 light years behind the summer solstice.
I'm afraid I don't understand that.
In elementary mathematical formulae, its gamma is to the power of epsilon to the 7th vector.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes, of course. Now, how is it we haven't observed your planetoid before? I couldn't find you on any of our star atlases.
We're exactly opposite your sun. This would make observation by ordinary optical instruments impossible. But with our magnetic electroscope, we are able to filter out the sol rays and observe you perfectly.
I see. Oh, I see, Commander. When do you expect to arrive?
By your time, late in your so-called afternoon. We shall determine that by later contact.
And, Commander, might I ask a personal question?
Of course.
What do you, what do you look like?
Like all members of the race Delta of the Nebulae Ursula, of course. Is there any other way to look?
At 35 Crescent Heights. My husband just made contact with a Delta Zero something in space. They're going to land this afternoon.
Oh, will you say that a little slower, please?
I said that the men from space are going to land this afternoon. I heard my husband talking to them. You've got to send the policeman out of here because of the
flood. Oh, yes, yes, ma'am. Now, take it easy. How did you say your husband got this information?
Through the radio.
Oh, sure. Sure, I understand.
these spacemen radioed your husband.
But I keep telling you, I heard them. The door was open. I could hear them very distinctly. Oh, please, please, you've got to sit down.
This sounds like a matter for the Army, Mrs. Tanner. Why don't you call them?
Oh, but I don't know why I can't. All right, I'll call them. Oh, what's their number? Oh, please, please, hurry.
Well,
hurry,
one moment.
Please, hurry, hurry.
It's Murata 4637.
Thank you. I'll call them right away.
Yeah, you do that, Mrs. Tanner. Yes. And they'll take care of What's it about, please?
We're being invaded by Delta White. I mean, it's space. It's a
car. Hold the line, please. I'll give you the duty officer.
Are you still...
Officer of the day, Lieutenant Jacobs.
My name is Mrs. Tanner, Mrs. Albert Tanner, 35 Crescent Heights. Now, please, please, you've got to send soldiers out here right away. My husband is dying to death.
Oh, that's interesting, Commander. How long have you been in space?
By your time, 5 months. But remember, our speed is twice the speed of light.
Uh-huh. You use atomic energy?
Discarded in our bleak age. We use the natural magnetic forces that surround the universe.
Well, what about friction heat caused by your velocity through the atmosphere?
Our speed is adjustable by control of the magnetic fields we ride in. In any case, the disc hull is of Trexendium. It's pressured to withstand anything. Anything that is but water.
But water? But everything in nature has water. Even the human body is 80% water.
What? You have water in your body?
Yes. It's in different forms. Things such as blood or sweat, but it's still water.
Well, thank you for warning us.
What's wrong with water?
To humans, apparently, nothing. But to our life form, water is a deadly corrosive.
But our atmosphere contains water.
We know, and have sufficient exterior protection for the moisture of your atmosphere. Did you say your habitation was inland?
Yes. Yes, you're perfectly safe, sir. We're over 100 miles from the nearest ocean or river. Now, if you will follow my carrier signal down to the landing, you'll be all right.
Thank you, Tanner. I'll report your assistance to the Council. Do you think your authorities will object to our visit?
I'm sure they won't, sir. They'll be honored. We'll all be honored.
Listen, I need a bad noise. Is it a joke? Are you not going to help?
Mrs. Tanner, the CEO is away for the weekend, and I've got an appointment. Can't it wait till Monday?
Look, either you send help right away, or I'll send a report of your conduct to my congressman. We'll have a copy to your commanding general.
Yes, Mrs. Tanner. I'll be over.
Do you really trust that human, Commander?
So there isn't much option. We've orders to carry out. It's an incredible race. The Tenor seems harmless enough.
We're meeting pressure, Riz.
Probably entering the outer atmosphere. Better start degaussing and settle on his carrier.
2700-02. No change.
Switch on the water oscillograph.
Oscillograph on.
Variation?
None.
Good. We'd better check again with Tanner until we see ground.
Right away, Riz.
Delta to MXA. Delta to MXA. Over.
MXA to Delta. You're in, loud and strong.
We're entering your atmosphere.
I'll check your approach on radar and keep tracking you.
We're going off ether. Leave your channel open.
Yeah, Martha, I thought I told you.
This is Lieutenant Spencer from Casa El Jalgis. I heard you talking to the Delta man, and I'm a little scared.
Your wife was worried, though. She wanted me to come over.
Oh, I see. I suppose she told you a story about men from space?
Well, yes, sir.
Oh, all right. You probably think I'm crazy, but you'll see. They're coming in right now, using my channel as a ground approach. You've been through signal school?
I'm from 27th Signal Corps, sir.
I see. Then you'll recognize the equipment.
Something wrong, Ron. Wrong. Reverse the field. There's water.
Tanner.
We're approaching water.
Tanner. Cross check our position. We have a danger reading.
You're heading straight for us, Commander. You're safe. Why, you're perfectly safe.
Check it again.
There's a great deal of water.
Did you check it again?
Yes, I did. There's a great deal of water in it.
Tanner.
A great big body of water.
The water down there. Tanner, our signals are in danger. Strong danger. Cross-check your fix.
Cover of this, the magnet. It's water. It's water. Masses and masses of water.
Delta! What's happened?
Cross-check their position, sir. The signal's getting weaker, but your fix is right. It's within 100 yards of this set.
Let's get outside. Maybe it's crashed into the field.
Where is it? There's nothing out there.
But there must be. Maybe it's crashed into the trees or... Come on, come on.
Albert! Look!
Read it, sir, but I don't...
Go on. Go on.
On Saturday, July 14th at 1400 hours, a telephone call was received from Mrs. Albert Tanner, et cetera, and so forth. And on going out to the back lot, we could see no sign of the space disk. Our attention was then drawn by Mrs. Tanner to the fish pond from which steam could be seen rising. On inspecting the pond, a small circular object approximately 8 inches in diameter could be seen floating on the surface. On attempting to retrieve the object, it disintegrated as if attacked by a powerful corrosive. End of report.
Well, you forgot about the men inside. You've got to say something about their size.
We never saw them, Mr. Tanner.
What are you doing? Don't do that! Well, you can't.
Mr. Tanner, I'm doing this for both of us. If I sent in the report, nobody would believe it. It's better this way.
No! It's the truth! You saw it happen? Why, you know it happened.
The only thing I know is there's no proof. As far as I'm concerned, it didn't happen. I never saw anything. I never heard anything. That's going to be my report, Mr. Tanner. No occurrence. Incident closed. Good afternoon, Miss Tanner.
Under the direction of Anthony Ellis, Escape has brought you The Invader by Michael Gray, starring Howard McNair. Faye Baker was heard as Martha, with Edgar Berrier as the commander. Featured in the cast were Paul Frees, Peter Leeds, Bill Bissell, and Leroy Leonard. The special music for Escape is composed and conducted by Lee Stevens.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one. Do you remember that Twilight Zone now? Did you see it? The one where Agnes Moorehead played an old lady in a small cabin beset by teeny tiny little robots. And that voice I was talking about, did you notice it? Did you recognize Howard McNear? They mentioned his name later. You may remember, I think everybody has at some point or another in their life watched The Andy Griffith Show with Little Opie, Sheriff Taylor, and Floyd the Barber. That's right. Floyd the Barber was played by Howard McNear.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to offer you another short story in the series designed to disclose the origins of superstition. This time, we invade the nursery and reveal the origin of the terror of children, the boogeyman.
Betty, stop! I'll never get this scarf finished if you keep pulling at it. Now, if you don't stop bothering me, I'll tell the boogeyman to get you when you're in the dark by yourself.
Oh, no, Dorothy. Please don't tell the boogeyman.
Why, Dorothy, you shouldn't frighten your little sister like that.
Auntie Helen, please ask Dorothy not to let the boogeyman get me.
No, no, Betty, dear. There's no such thing as a boogeyman. Don't think about it anymore. Now run along to Grandma's room and visit with her.
All right, Aunt Helen.
Dorothy, dear, I'm surprised at you. You're old enough to know better than to put such a dreadful thought on your little sister's mind. Do you realize that it makes a deep impression on a sensitive child, instilling a fear of the dark that sometimes takes years to eradicate?
But it's the only thing that'll make her stop annoying me, Aunt Helene.
Well, you should try some other means of making her behave. For it was just such a thought as that that frightened a child to death hundreds of years ago and started that belief in the boogeyman.
Why? How was that, Aunt Helene?
Well, it has to do with an incident that took place in a little village in Serbia. Oh, about the latter part of the 9th century, I should think. It was soon after the majority of the people had been converted to Christianity. However, before that, they had believed in their own gods of nature. But when they accepted the supreme god that the Christ had proclaimed, they discarded their old gods, or bogs, as they called them.
Bogs? Why, that's almost like boogie.
Yes. That's what the word boogie is derived from. For as the belief was spread into different countries, the word changed slightly from time to time to boog, boogleboo, boogie, and various other forms.
Why, how interesting, Aunt Helene.
Yes, isn't it? But to go on. Among the people were some who were not converted to the new faith. They continued to believe in the old god of their ancestors, the god of the sun, the bog, as he was called. These people used to meet secretly in the mountains to worship him. They even sacrificed innocent victims to gratify the demands of De Bog, hoping to secure his favor and bring good to themselves.
You mean they killed human beings as a sacrifice, Aunt Helene?
That's right, Dorothy. Now it so happened that there had been a storm that had lasted for some days, and the sun had been hidden from view. The worshippers of De Bog believed that he was angry with them and demanded a sacrifice. So one night, their leader, whose name was Dushan, called them to meet in their secret place in the mountains so that they might offer up a sacrifice to appease the wrath of their god. And
listen, my people. The mighty wrath of De Bog is upon us. For days he has not shown us his face. He is displeased with us. We must make sacrifice or he will forsake us.
Hey, Dushan.
What shall we do to appease the powerful bog of the sun?
We must sacrifice one who is innocent and pure, a child of tender years.
Aye, Dushan, and I know of such a child.
Stand forth, Kara. Speak. Tell us where we may find her.
She is Melina, the youngest daughter of Stefan, a devout Christian, the wealthiest man in the village of Kuva, that is at the foot of these mountains.
Ah, the child of Stefan. You hate Stefan, eh, Kara? Ever since he caught you in dishonest bargaining with him?
Aye. And I hate him because he's a Christian, too, Dushan.
Good, Kara. Then Stefan's child shall be our sacrifice.
Aye, Dushan.
You, Kara, shall go after her, for you know how the interior of the house is arranged. Kaloyan and Vukhan will assist you.
But, Dushan, what if all doth not go well and the Christians should recognize me?
Do not fear, Kara. I have prepared for that. You shall wear the horrible mask of the Bog of Darkness. Then, should anything go amiss, you have only to pretend that you are the Bog himself.
Aye, thou art wise, Dushan. At last I will have my revenge.
Now, this is what you three must do. When you are certain that the child isn't there to speak, you, Kara, climb through the window into the child's room, seize her, and pass her out the window into the arms of Kaloyan and Vukhan. Then secure the girl in this goatskin and hurry back, so we can make sacrifice to the Bog at break of day.
'Tis well, Dushan.
Take care, Kara, that no suspicion fall upon us. Away, then, and make haste, for the wrath of the Bog doth grow more great. We must gratify him.
We go, Dushan, to the house of Stefan for our sacrifice.
And may the Bog assist you.
Stefan, my husband.
Yes, Draga. What is it?
Our little one, Melina, will not go to bed.
It is late. It is long past her bedtime. What is the matter with her?
She is afraid of the dark, Stefan.
Such nonsense. Come, Melina, tell your father and mother why you are afraid of the dark.
When Mara and I were playing in the pasture today, Father, the old woman Melissa stopped us and told us if we did not pray to the Bog, he would send the Bog of Darkness to punish us.
What? That old sorceress Melissa said that? Then it is true what they say in the village, that old Melissa does not believe in the God of the Christ.
Yes, and she said he'd eat us up with his big mouth that covers most of his face if we didn't.
No, no, Milena, my child, you must not believe that.
What old Melissa has told you, my daughter, is not true. Do not think of it anymore. Put it to bed, Draga.
Come, Melina. Say goodnight to your father and to the rest of the family.
Good night, Father. Good night, all of you.
Good night, Melina.
Good night, little sister.
Good night, Melina.
Oh, how cold it is in this bedroom, Mother dear.
Well, hurry. Let me undress you quickly and tuck you into bed. Then you'll be snug and warm.
How much noise the sky makes, Mother. Oh, I'm afraid. Don't leave me.
We will be close by you, darling, in the room right next to you.
But it will be so dark when you go, and I'm afraid of the bog.
Nonsense, Melina. You have never been like this before. Now stop talking of such a thing. Into bed with you. There. Now let me tuck you in. Now, isn't that nice?
Oh, but I don't want you to leave me, Mother, please. I'm so afraid.
Mother has work to do yet to prepare for the feast tomorrow. Besides, if you just say your prayers, the Supreme God will protect you from any harm. Now kiss me. Be a good girl. And go to sleep.
Oh, I'm so afraid, Mother. The bog might hurt me.
Hush. Now go to sleep, Melina. Good night, dear.
At last, brothers. The mother has left the room. The child is now in bed. Here's our chance. Help me to get through the window.
But, Kara, it is too soon. Why not wait till the child falls asleep? She may scream if she sees you.
Nay, Kaloyan, we must hurry. Do not fear, for I will be careful. Come, help me.
Very well, Kara. Vukhan and I will stand close to the window and seize the child as you pass her out to us. Come, Vukhan. Let us lift Kara through the window. There. There, Kaloyan is in. I hope he hurries. If we should get caught by these Christians, it would mean death to us. Nay, do not fear, Bukon. We have the power of Dubab with us.
Mother, it's the bug! What is it, Melina? Stefan! Stefan! Look! That horrible creature!
Where? Oh, I see it! I saw it then in the flash of lightning near the window. It's a bug of darkness, Draga. Quick, Michael, a light!
Melina! Melina! Child! Speak to me! Speak!
Here's the light, Stefan.
The bog is gone. Michael, Nicholas, Penka, hurry. Search the ground to see if you can find any trace of him.
Yay, Stefan.
Melina!
What's the matter, Draga?
Oh, Stefan, I cannot rouse Melina. She is dead.
Dead? Alas, then, the bog of darkness has left his mark.
And so, because of the storm that washed away any trace of the footprints of Kara and his companions, the people believed that it had been the bog of darkness that had been there and killed the child, then vanished into thin air, whereas in reality, the child had died of fright. So gradually, the belief in the boogeyman was spread about into other countries and has remained even unto this day. Now, you see how ridiculous it is to say such a thing, Dorothy.
Ridiculous? But I don't see anything ridiculous in that. After all, the little child died.
Yes, but Dorothy, don't you see? If that old woman had not told Melina that the bog would get her, she wouldn't have been so terrified of the dark. But because that thought possessed her mind so strongly, anything that had come into her room would have affected her in the same way. For she was worked up to such a terrific pitch that the strain was too much for her delicate heart, and she died of fright.
Yes, Aunt Helena, that's true, but I...
Aunt Helene, Mother says I gotta go to bed now, and I don't want to, because I'm afraid of the boogeyman.
That's nonsense, Betty. Now, you go up to bed like a good girl.
No, I won't go unless Dorothy comes too.
Well, I'm not coming. I'm going out with Tom this evening.
Well, I'll come with you, Betty.
No, no. I want Dorothy. She knows the boogeyman, and you don't. And she can tell him to leave me alone. I won't go without Dorothy.
Oh, good heavens. You're a perfect nuisance.
You see, Dorothy, now will you ever tell Betty about the boogeyman again, my dear?
I should say not.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, Dorothy probably means what she says and will not tell little Betty about the boogeyman anymore. That is, not until she gets provoked again. Well, au revoir and good luck to you.
From the origin of superstition, sometimes also called superstition in the air, which ran in 1935. I have most of them and will sprinkle them in from time to time. They're not all quite that melodramatic, but a lot of them are. Well, this marks the end of the dramatic presentation phase of night transmissions. From here on in, it's just gonna be music. I do want to invite you to write me with any ideas you have, any program you'd like to hear, praise, condemnation, really anything, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I'd also like to encourage you to drop by the website, www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is just one word. There you'll find all sorts of ancillary material on these shows. Some things that don't actually make it into the... Some things that aren't quite appropriate for the show. By appropriate, I just mean they don't quite fit in for the show. In some cases, there are PDF files and e-books of the stories that the radio plays are based on. I even sometimes find video clips that I think are somehow relevant. I must admit that sometimes the definition of relevant is rather loose. Anyway, write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Come by the website at www.nighttransmissions.com. I'm going to shut up now, and I hope to see you next week. Well, I won't exactly see you. I mean, how could I possibly see you? But, well, you can't even see me, can you? You'll just have to listen out. But if you'll write me, I'll listen.
Blackwater Hattie lived back in the swamp where strange green reptiles crawl, where the swamp is alive with a thousand eyes, and all of them watching you. Stay off the track of Hattie Shack in the back of the Black Bayou. Way up the road from Hattie Shack lies a sleepy little Okeechobee town. Talk of swamp witch Hattie lock you in when the sun go down. Rumors of what she done, rumors of what she'd do, kept folks off a track of Hattie Shack in the back of the Black Bayou. One day brought the rain stayed on, and the swamp water overflowed. Skeeters and the fever grabbed the town like a fist. Doc Jackson was the first to go. Some said the plague was brought by Hattie. There was talk of a hanging too, but the talk got shackled by the howls and the cackles from the bowels of the Black Bayou. Early one morn, between dark and dawn, when shadows fill the sky, there came an unseen caller on a town where hope run dry. In the square there was found a big black round vat full of gurgling brew, whispering sounds as the folks gathered round. It came from the Black Bayou. Ain't much pride when you're trapped inside a slowly sinking ship. Scooped up the liquid deep and green, and the whole town took a sip. Fever went away, and the very next day the skies again were blue. Let's thank old Hattie for saving our town. We'll fetch it from the Black Bayou. Party of 10 of the town's best men headed for Hattie Shack. Said swamp witch magic was useful and good, and they're gonna bring Hattie back. Never found Hattie, and they never found the shack, and they never made a trip back in. Cause a parchment note they found tacked to a stump said, don't come looking again.
There's a man who leads.
leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name. Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. What you say, or you give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian man. They've given you a number and taken away your name. Slip while kissing persuasive lips. The odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
Thinking back the tears. try and change your mind. And I think I'm gonna miss you for a long, long time. 'Cause I done everything I know to try and make you mine. And I think I'm gonna love you for a long, long time. Often she has gazed from castle windows all, and watched the daylight passing within her captive wall, with no one to heed her call. The evening hour is fading within the dwindling sun. And in a lonely moment, those embers will be gone, and the last of all the young birds flown. Her days of precious freedom forfeited long before, to live such fruitless years behind a guarded door. But those days will last no more. The lonely, fathering gaze.